What I really enjoy by cycling long distances by myself is that I know that there is no one that's going to come to solve any problem if there's any problem that arises. And I love this life reminder that, yeah, that's fine. Nobody's going to come. I don't need anyone to come. I can manage. You make decisions much faster. You categorize options much faster. You keep calm much more easily. You become the leader of yourself in a very organic and simple way. And I find that this is daily life lessons that enrich you as you cycle.
Welcome to the Seek Travel Ride podcast, where we share the stories and experiences of people who have undertaken amazing adventures by bike. Whether it's crossing state borders, mountain ranges, countries, or continents, we want to share that spirit of adventuring on two wheels with our listeners. Welcome to the Seek Travel Ride podcast. I'm Bella Malloy, and today I'm really excited to share the story of our guest, Dr. Florence Cattell. Florence, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very excited.
Great. So, Florence, what I like to do with my podcast, and I ask this of all of my guests, is a very simple question at the start, and it is, can you please describe the very first bike that you rode?
Yes, I very much can. This was a bicycle that was up for rental in the city of Copenhagen. It was a bicycle that worked like trolleys where you put a coin in and that's how you can detach it from the stand. The story is that I moved to Copenhagen when I was 25 and I didn't know how to cycle. I had never been on a bicycle and I didn't want to say it to anyone because I was very aware that it's unusual, especially in Denmark, to be an adult and not to know how to cycle. So I took this bicycle at night and I was teaching myself when everybody was asleep. So it's quite an unusual bicycle to be a first bicycle.
That story in itself is actually quite a magic one to hear. I always prepare myself for hearing about people telling me their stories of when they were 3 or 4 years old, or, you know, very, very young and there's a child. And, you know, some people might tell me about, you know, no training wheels, or, you know, their bike was pink or it made noises. But to discover the joy of cycling as an adult, I actually want to delve into that a little bit. So how was it that with your situation, it was until you were an adult that you first started cycling?
Yes, it was extremely scary, actually. It took a long time. And by that, I mean weeks, for me to be able to just accept to let go, I would say, and accept to have enough momentum that I'd be able to build up a little bit of speed, because that's how you build balance. I fell many times. And what was even funnier, I would say, is that when I finally developed a bit of balance and I decided to buy a bicycle and stop taking the city ones, I went to a shop and I bought a secondhand bicycle, but I didn't want to try it in the shop because my balance was still not the similar level than everybody in the city, especially in Denmark. So I just looked at the bicycle, I bought it, I pushed it back home.
Wow.
And that night when I finally tried it on, it was too big, because the Danes are the second tallest people in the world. And even if lowering the level of the saddle to the minimum, my legs were not long enough to touch the pedals. So I was too ashamed. I offered the bicycle to a friend and I bought another one in another shop.
Wow. And so also just trailing back, so you taught yourself on a Copenhagen sort of city bike share scheme bike, and you did this in the nighttime as well. So just to add an extra complexity to it, like you're learning balance as an adult, but you're also doing it at nighttime.
Yeah, I would say actually that it was really lowering the complexity because there was only myself. The only mental barriers were my fear of falling. The fact that it was at night really made it much easier for me to just focus on me and not think of what the world may be thinking of myself. Because for people that have never been to Denmark, really Danes, it's almost as if they were born with bicycles between their legs. This is not something that they can understand, that an adult that has a body without any disability cannot cycle.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I actually wonder how many adults there are that where cycling isn't something that they had discovered as a child.
I think they are more than what we imagine in the Western world, because later in life, at different moments and in different cities, I've seen women trying to cycle with someone holding them in the street, and I had this beautiful moment and joy of stopping by and sharing my story in just 2-3 sentences and telling them, I know how happy you'll be when you finally can make it, and I'm very excited for you, and congratulations.
Oh, what? And again, it's that you've had that experience as an adult, so you can empathize with what they're feeling at the time.
Completely relate.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. So can we just take the time now, Florence, just to give our listeners a bit of background to yourself?
Sure. I am French. I grew up in Paris. I am a neuroscientist. Since the age of maybe 8, I've had in mind this very big dream of understanding how the brain works in order to, well, help people with their mental health. And I studied in Paris, then moved to Copenhagen to work for the University of Copenhagen as a neuroscientist. And after learning to cycle by myself, I went on a long trip and cycled from north to south of South America to finally be able to say that now I had really developed the balance. And after that, I moved to Australia to pursue different type of work in neuroscience. And I've been living in Australia now for 10 years and working on different projects, mostly at the moment helping very different types of scientists to connect across disciplines, across institutions, to tackle more complex problems together. And at the moment, I'm getting into a new endeavor focusing on prevention of burnout and quiet quitting, using my skills of leadership, neuroscience, capacity of understanding how organizations and complex problems can be managed to help people feel that they can achieve whatever they care about through their work.
I feel that that particular part of your research would be just absolutely fascinating. For me personally, it's fascinating. We'll probably get into this further into our discussions today, but I wonder also how the research and the knowledge that you've built up as a neuroscientist has informed and assisted you with achieving some of your endurance feats that we'll talk about today as well. So on the topic of endurance, your participation in endurance sports, it wasn't necessarily sports in general weren't necessarily something that interested you as a child. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. As a teenager, I thought that I was a brain, that happened to have limbs. That's really how I pictured myself. I was doing no sport unless the teacher was kind of forcing me at school, I would say. And I really thought that in a way I couldn't.
I visually have this like cartoon illustration of like a pink brain with like little stick legs and little arms sort of pointing around, and then that's how you pictured yourself. So you told yourself, or you had this internal voice with yourself that no, sport wasn't for you, and so you avoided sports through your childhood then?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a bit advanced at school. I was very good at mathematics. And I think I developed quite early on this idea that this was this thing. I could deal with numbers. I could solve complicated equations. And that was it. In life, you could do one thing. That was mine. I really didn't realize how a person can be multifaceted, I would say.
Okay, so then how did you make that shift? How did you change your perception from sports are not for me, it's not something I participate in, to all of a sudden beginning to participate and enjoy, perhaps, in sporting activities?
That's a very good question. What happened? I think that when I was a teenager, I was a shy person. And one day I decided I didn't want to be shy anymore. And actually just taking that decision worked. The next day I woke up and I wasn't shy anymore. And that was probably maybe a few years later when I realized that I had made that switch so quickly and that it was really holding on to one decision. I understood that if I had done that for one thing, I could do this for many others. And there would be no turning back from that point.
So it was almost like a switch went off overnight. I'm not shy, I can do this. And it was like a self-belief moment.
Yeah, I think so. And a moment of taking my own life in my own hands.
Are you a fan of global travel? Are you wanting to see more of the world yourself? Well, then you're my kind of people. My name is DeAndre Koch, and I'm the host of the travel podcast, Revolutionizing Your Journey, where we share stories of everyday people making the most of global travel and also teach you how to do the same yourself. You'll hear stories from people just like you who learned how to travel for nearly free, like Jo, who realized she could take her daughter to Disneyland in Tokyo for cheaper than in the US, or Rob, who flew his entire family of seven to Europe round trip in business class, all for less than the price of economy. Check out the link in the description for the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast to learn how to elevate your own travels.
Oh, all these doors began to open for you, and the door of endurance activities began to open for you as well. So can you give us a little bit of a background of the first type of endurance sports that you participated in?
I guess the first one was running a marathon. And that would be very much linked to my move to Denmark, because as I was studying and working in France, it's very common to work very long hours and nobody sees this as an issue. But in Denmark, the culture is very different and Danes are extremely productive. It's quite phenomenal how much work they can get done in a few hours. And that is because they want to leave work early and focus very strongly on their family, their friends, their leisure. And so everybody was almost putting pressure on me at the university, telling me to leave work early. There was a professor that was telling me, you work too much, go home. And I started being bored, and I really felt I was extremely active in France. I was volunteering for the French Red Cross. That's something I did for a decade. As I was studying at university, I was also working in a supermarket to earn money. I had many friends. I was also volunteering in a research lab during my studies. My schedule was full on. And in Denmark, I didn't have the number of friends. I was not working 80 hours a week in the lab. I was earning money, so I didn't need to do a student job anymore. So I developed other interests, and that's when I realized that I could cycle, I felt like kind of pushing another door. And I was already running a little bit, maybe half an hour to an hour once a week. And I just thought, maybe I can actually run much longer and more often. And I did.
And so then you became a marathon runner.
Yes.
Did you go straight to, was the marathon the first type of running event you entered? Or did you have like the 5K fun run or a 10 kilometer run? Or, you know, there's one thing to enjoy an hour of running. 42 kilometers? Or
yes.
Yes, it is vastly different.
I think I did a 10 kilometer once with a friend, because the friend had registered, and I wanted to like be there with her. And I did run a half marathon, I think before the marathon, but in my mind, like none of this mattered. It was the marathon that I was going for. It was the other runs were training.
Was it something specifically about the challenge?
It was just the perfect distance for me to think that maybe I could, maybe I could not. And achieving it was touching, felt like it would be touching my limits. And that's definitely what I was after and what I am still after in kind of everything that I do. Approaching my limits and seeing if I can touch them or if I can push them. I get a lot of joy out of that.
Wow, so extending yourself and seeing what's possible.
Yes. And I think if anybody from the audience is into long-distance cycling, they can really relate to these sensations that you can have when you've been doing sport, exercising for a few hours, this kind of internal joy that comes mixed with very strong emotions. That's fantastic sensations, and I think that's what I go after.
I can totally resonate with that. For me, that's the moment where I find that I hit that internal state of flow. I'm in that flow state mindset where I lose time because I'm so in the moment. I'm so mindful of the activity that I'm doing, and it's a positive experience. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, for me, it becomes pure joy.
So running was the first sort of endurance type of sport that you liked and that was, I'm not sure if the word passion is the right one. Perhaps it is, but it's something that you really enjoyed to participate in. You then learnt how to ride a bike. And I think also, Florence, you participated in an Ironman as well. You are an Ironman?
Yes, I am an Ironman, yes.
Wow. So combining running with swimming and then cycling?
Yes. The story is that as I was preparing to cycle in South America, from north to south to South America, I for 2 months I stayed in Zurich. And one weekend, there was an Ironman organized there all around the lake. And I didn't know what Ironman was. I was just walking there a Saturday afternoon. I saw there was a lot of activity, went to check what it was. And if you've ever been close to the course of an Ironman, you know the energy, the joy, the enthusiasm, the excitation that emanates from it is absolutely fantastic. And I think I fell in love with the event on that day. And I was preparing to cycle thousands of kilometers in South America, but my mind was already after my mind had already done that and was thinking of how I could prepare for the Ironman that I was going to do when I'd come back.
Oh, wow.
I knew I could manage the run. I was going to like definitely train on my cycling, and the swim was going to be the challenge. I could swim, but I could swim breaststroke. I had never learned freestyle or never well enough so that I could swim freestyle long distance. And so after cycling in South America, like as soon as I put my bicycle back in a box, I was already thinking, okay, now I need to learn to swim.
I'm still yet to meet an Ironman who has enjoyed the swimming leg. That signs up because swimming is their thing.
There are a few, but it's a minority.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? If there's any listeners to the show that are Ironman and love swimming, please reach out to me. I feel like I could talk to you about Ironman for a while, but I do want to go into your trip through South America. It's a monumental journey. And you started in Ecuador and the finish was in Argentina, that's correct?
Yes, absolutely. I started in Quito, which is the capital of Ecuador, which is basically on the line of the equator, and finished in Ushuaia, the most southern point of the continent, going through the Andes, Peru, Bolivia, and Chile, Argentina, back and forth until the most southern point.
What is the exact distance?
So I went there with my the person that was my partner at the time, and the deal between us was that we were not going to carry anything electronic. We had no help whatsoever. So we didn't have any computer nor sports watch, but just trying to look at the map, that's about 12,000 kilometers.
The idea of not collecting any, or traveling with anything electronic, was that because you wanted to make this a purely organic experience?
Yeah, I should say we did have a camera, but no help whatsoever. Absolutely, something very organic, and also a lot of people feel the need of sharing online exactly the distances, their speed, the time they spend on the saddle, and we really wanted our experience to be for ourselves. And not, as we were cycling, not be thinking of what anyone would say about it, positive, negative, whatever. Just keep the experience where it was and live in the present.
Oh, I love that you took that decision at the outset.
Yes, yes. Well, a good phone could have been a good idea. And 10 years later, I would actually not recommend, if anybody's listening, I absolutely do not recommend you to cycle across the Salar de Uyuni without a GPS, nor Suplipes, the desert in Bolivia, because we did get lost for 3 days in the desert, in the middle of nowhere. Truly lost. We ran out of water. Our stove broke down. This was a really serious situation. So I don't think that in that area, it's something very wise. We did carry a compass, but it happens that there's a lot of lithium in the ground and the compass doesn't work in many areas of Bolivia.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that that was a thing.
Yes. That's why a GPS can actually be good.
It's interesting because I actually have it as a question I wanted to ask you, and I feel like I'm going to ask you this now because that trip, you know, from, I think you describe it as cycling from the middle of the earth to the end of the earth, or the bottom of the earth, I think.
Yes, absolutely, because the line of equator is basically the middle of the earth. And Ushuaia is called, has the nickname of El Fin del Mundo, the end of the world, yeah.
I love that you've taken on a challenge that's taken you from middle earth to end of the world. I think that's great. This large route, that it's got some challenging environments in it as well. So, and you mentioned the troubles that you had there in the desert. You're also coming across, you know, cycling at altitude as well.
Absolutely. And I had no experience whatsoever in that. And I had altitude sickness the first time that I reached above 3,000 meters high. Luckily, the first time was in Ecuador. We didn't stay that high for very long. And I think the second time when we came back up in Peru to altitudes above 3,000 kilometers in Peru, you are constantly in the north, eastern part, north part. You're constantly going very high, dropping down to 2,000 meters, back to 4,000, back to 2,000. So you never stay, you don't stay for very long in altitude. It's back and forth, I would say. And I think that this was a good preparation for then Bolivia, where we stayed for a long time, over months, and then Chile, Argentina. In total, we probably spent 2 months in a row at a like flirting with 4,000 meters high.
Wow, that's phenomenal. Can I ask, did you go to South America from Copenhagen?
Yes. Well, I just spent two months in Zurich, and then yes, yeah, absolutely.
Because I was going to say your base training then was not very high at all, and then all of a sudden, Ecuador at the very start of your trip has quite high altitude.
Yeah, absolutely. Quito is, for what I remember, 2,800 meters high, I think. Yes, we were straight into it.
You would have known this before you started. So were there preparations that you had in mind, or was it like the rest of your trip, this was going to be an organic experience?
Yeah, there was some preparation for sure, managing the distance, like physical preparation, just to be able to manage physical exercise on consecutive days and for a long period of time. Then regarding altitude, there was definitely none, because it's quite tricky to take yourself to places that would be of high altitude in Europe, I would say, for long enough. And we had done a 4-day trip to Cyprus in order to train cycling in hills. That was definitely very limited, just enough for me to know that I did not like it. So I was not looking forward to that part.
I could tag team with you. I love hills. It's the flats that do my head in.
No, I can stay on the flats for a very, very long time. But the hills, I find that, well, I mean, I've grown to, at some point, if you go for really long distances, you end up loving everything, I think. And you know how to manage yourself so that you can enjoy whatever comes. And I've definitely learned that. But if I can choose, yeah, I'd probably go flat.
What about if it's windy? Yeah.
Would be my definition of hell, probably. Or, but the way I try to see it now is I feel alive because I feel the elements. And I try to think of it as just a reminder that I'm very lucky that I can feel things. I feel even more connected with the environment. That's how I try to put it under a romantic angle and try to enjoy a situation that usually nobody enjoys. Cycling with headwind is not the favorite for a cyclist.
No, I always say that wind is like the worst of the weather when you're on a bike. But I also, just hearing you there, and it's something that's coming through already, it's that mindset and it's that, you know, that perception change. Just as you told yourself when you were younger, you're not shy anymore, you can do these. Now you have this strategy where you're telling yourself, yeah, it's windy, but that means I'm alive and I'm feeling. And so it's that changing that perception of what may perhaps be an uncomfortable situation into a, no, it's totally okay and manageable. I love that. You have a quote on your site which says, if you have a goal, you have a sun to show you the way out of any desert. I love that. Can you take us back to that scenario in the desert, being lost there?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Bolivia, we crossed the desert. It took in total 11 days. It should have taken 8 to 9. And that is because at some point we got completely lost. What I have to explain is that there are no roads. There are tracks. And if there are too many tracks, then it's the same as having no tracks at all, because you absolutely do not know what to follow, where to go. And we hit both situations where there were areas where there were way too many tracks. We didn't know which direction to go, and areas where there were no tracks anymore at all. And for 3 days, the only way that we could manage and keep on going without a GPS, without a compass that would work, was just to stick to our goal. That was to go and reach the most southern part of the continent. And the way to find the south is just to follow the sun. And that's when we finally found a track, and then we came out of the desert and I saw asphalt. I kissed the road. Because it really felt like we were safe and we were going to find food and we were going to find clean water and we were safe. We were back on track. And I thought of that experience many, many times in life, because I think everybody at some point feels like they're crossing a desert. And I managed to get out because we had a very clear goal. And thanks to that, we had a direction. And I think that each time that we feel we're lost in the desert, if we can go back to our goal, then it's like the sun that can show us the direction, where to go, where to keep on pushing to find the exit.
Florence, there's people who come across affirmations, you know, or sayings that resonate for them, and they're random things. But to have such a strong experience, which has become that life-affirming affirmation for you, wow.
And I have a few pictures of myself pushing my bicycle or trying to ride my bicycle in this desert. And for a lot of people, it looks like a beautiful landscape, such an enjoyable experience. For me, it will always resonate as what I can take myself out of, the type of obstacles that I can travel through, that I can manage, and what I can achieve once I'm out.
Personally, what I take from that as someone who has experienced cycle touring before, the element of not having a choice but to problem solve, it's almost like when you go on a cycle tour, you don't realize it at the time, but it's almost like you've booked yourself on a crash course in problem solving and adaptability.
It is. And that's what I love about it. You put yourself in a situation where you know no one will come. And when you have that certainty, magically you remember that actually you don't need anyone to come. All the solutions are already in you.
I didn't realize that lithium impacts the ability for a compass to operate. I thought a compass was like the old school, you know, way that...
No, because it's magnetic.
So Florence, that experience of crossing an entire continent in South America, when did that occur?
When I turned 30. So 10 years ago.
You've drawn on so many of those experiences now, haven't you?
Yes, I think it enabled me to fully understand that the limits in life are the ones that you set yourself.
That we are our own limit.
Absolutely. So it means that if you don't want to set any limits, there are none.
So when you reached the end of the world in Ushuaia, in Argentina, what were you thinking at that point?
Iron Man!
You had already had your next goal.
Yes, but it took about 7 months to cycle from north to south, and I am somebody that really absolutely love neuroscience. This has never been like what people may call a job. An occupation. This has always been something that is almost a part of me. And I was extremely eager to get back into a lab and do experiments and read scientific articles that may seem very boring for some, but keep me extremely entertained. So when I reached the end of that journey, I was very emotional because there's always a very strong mix of being extremely happy to finish and at the same time being very sad that it's over. But to that cocktail was also added a very strong, like almost craving of more intellectual activities and getting back to what I had been doing before and getting back on the track of my neuroscience dream. With sprinkles of Iron Man, because I knew I was going for it.
How did you go in the Iron Man?
It took a long time for reasons that are actually not really linked to sport, more like material reasons and a few social things. But it took me 5 more years, I think, because I did other things in between. But I absolutely loved it, and now my goal is to still be doing Ironman at 80.
I recently found out that there is an Ultra Ironman.
Yes.
Have you heard of that before?
Of course, this is the next thing I'm preparing.
We might need to have you on as a guest again so we could talk about your lead up and your experience with that. That would be fantastic. Florence, you talk about how neuroscience and your research is just a part of your identity in your life, and that is ultimately what took you to move from Europe across over to Australia. If I fast forward a little bit, you joined the 7th cohort of Homeward Bound.
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit about that?
Homeward Bound is a leadership program for women for climate action. Basically, Mother Nature needs her daughters. The idea is that if we had more women at decision-making tables with a bit more confidence, maybe the leadership style adopted around the world would be a bit different and other types of decisions would be made. And long-term consequences of our actions may be taken into consideration a bit more often. So the Homeward Bound program really helps women from around the world who are from a science background come together. Every year they select 100 women with a science background from around the world to join a cohort. And for a year, there's online sessions about leadership, a lot of reflection as part of groups and self-reflections. And at the end of the year, the program concludes with a three-week trip to Antarctica, all together on a ship, in order to practice leadership in a difficult and challenging environment.
Very different to the desert that you found yourself in South America.
Very different when you think of the physical environment, but when you think of the symbolic environment, that may not be that different. The challenges can be the same.
So it came, Florence, that you joined this cohort in Homeward Bound and you were selected to be one of those 100 women. And so then that was the start of a new goal for you as well, wasn't it?
Yes, I've always thought of myself as a neuroscientist, and I never thought particularly of what I could do for climate action. I think that everybody always has to pick their fights, and I thought that maybe that wasn't my fight. But I realized that to preserve our planet, we need absolutely everybody. And even though I am not a climate scientist, I am somebody that can contribute through my capacity of bringing very different people together. And I think that's what the Homeward Bound has helped me realize. And I feel extremely blessed almost to be connected with absolutely amazing women from around the world. And with Homeward Bound, I've been thinking of what was going to be the next adventure, the next big project that I would not just think of as an idea in a future, but as something that I would be doing in my present. And in the late 2022, I cycled from Darwin to Adelaide as part of a fundraising campaign for the Homeward Bound program, but also to inspire people to realize their dreams and helping them, or just using examples and anecdotes from my trip to help them prepare for their own dream and for their own journey, so that I'm not the only one that transformed my ideas into a present, but that we all do the same, and hopefully people that have wonderful ideas of projects about things that could be done for climate action just do realize them now and not just in the future.
And I guess in terms of touching on that environmental theme as well, and also in challenging landscapes, you sign up on this dream of, well, I guess crossing another continent in Australia. It's a vast, vast space. And as an Australian, I haven't immediate appreciation of that environment that you're setting out to traverse. From Darwin to Adelaide, there is vast amounts of open nothingness and desert and extremes. So I guess there's an element of being in Mother Nature and witnessing the climate every single moment of that day as well.
Absolutely. And before going, everybody was telling me, oh, you're going to go for such long stretches of nothing. And I really disagree with that, because that's when you're in the middle of what seems to be nowhere that you realize that it's so full of so much that you just never have time to appreciate. and being by myself in what others described as long stretches, I was actually fully surrounded by nature and its diversity.
Is that another example of that perception switch, of that mindset that you were talking about as well?
Completely. I think that because I'm a neuroscientist and I worked at some point on to make it into something more simple, how we create an internal representation of the outside world, how our brain manages information. I have a different appreciation of what we think we live, what we think we see, what we think we hear, and I know how much it all is a construct of our brain and how just the thoughts that we decide to follow can influence that. And we really can decide whether we look at things from a positive or from a negative angle. And I think that when you understand that, you can decide to stay on the positive side.
Were there testing times on your journey where that choice, it wasn't an immediate one to be in that mindset, and you found yourself having to prompt that mental shift and perception?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's constantly an active process, and it almost feels that you reach moments where you can decide to go one way or another very, very often, and life tests you, like you're saying. I think to describe a bit this trip, going from Darwin to Adelaide is really going from north to south of Australia, crossing the center that is a bit like a desert. The outback is very remote. And the difficulties that I faced were twofold: heat, wind, heat in the north, wind in the south. And both definitely test you. I also arrived, my big dream was to reach Uluru, also called Ayers Rock, that is at the very center of Australia, on a bicycle. I had been there by car twice, and I really wanted to reach it on a bicycle, which I did. But when I arrived, it was pouring rain, and this was the moment that I had been dreaming of. I had been thinking of doing this for 6 years before I did it. And so it was really the moment that I had pictured, I had imagined almost the dance that I do, everything. And it was pouring rain, and I had to take off my raincoat and the shoe covers and everything. And instead of thinking, spiraling down and thinking, oh, it almost never rains there. It almost never rains. I thought, how lucky am I? Almost never rains. And I felt really proud of myself, I have to say, that moment. Because instead of thinking my dream has been kind of stolen from me, I thought, no, life is giving me an even better picture than the one I had imagined myself.
And in terms of that environment and setting and that picture, as an Australian, I've not been to Uluru as yet. It is a destination I definitely want to go and visit and connect with. But I have seen beautiful images and videos of Uluru in the rain.
Yes.
And it transforms like this massive rock. I'm sure that's not the technical term for it, but this big geological structure that's unlike anything anywhere else on Earth just transforms magically with the rain, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. So to add up to my story, on the way leading up to Uluru, it was pouring rain. It stopped just when I arrived. And so the following morning when I went to see the rock after settling down in the resort, which is kind of like the checkpoint that you have to stop and follow, it wasn't raining anymore. So I didn't I didn't get to see the waterfalls on the rock, which is the thing that everybody says is absolutely magical. But I did get to see a bit of like drizzle on the rock. And it is fascinating how it's a very orange-looking rock on every postcard, which it is when the weather is very good, which is most of the time. And as soon as it drizzles a little bit, it changes color completely. And it is a very, very special place. It forces you to be almost spiritual, because after cycling for so long in extremely flat environment, seeing a rock so big being erected in the middle of nowhere is it makes you ask yourself a lot of questions.
What sort of questions?
You almost ask yourself questions about life. It's a very interesting place because a lot of people stick around there, and a lot of people are that come visit it and stay for a few days are at kind of pivoting moments in their lives. And it's the center of the continent, and it almost feels as if people were going there to try to find what's at the center of themselves.
Florence, there is an event called Race to the Rock. You may have come across it before, but it actually, each year it starts from a different, generally from a different capital city. And the idea is to for riders in an ultra cycling event to ride from that city all the way to Uluru. If you're tempted to push your endurance boundaries to a very different type of cycling, maybe look this one up.
I thought, and there's a run also from Alice Springs to Uluru.
Oh, wow. Trail running.
For me, the outback is something that I enjoy even more if I'm not by myself, but with myself.
You see yourself as your own company in that way.
And I'm very social, but...
Are you social with yourself?
Yeah, I'm social with myself. I'm an extremely social person in life. But there are experiences that I want to enjoy with myself, and that means just myself.
So this journey that you took from Darwin to Adelaide through the centre of Australia was different for multiple reasons to your experience touring through South America. One of the real contrasts there is that this time you were travelling on your own as a solo female traveller. What was that experience like?
I really enjoyed it, and I think I even prefer traveling by myself than traveling with someone. When you travel with a heavily loaded bicycle, no matter where you are, if there's anyone around, the bicycle acts like a magnet. Everybody comes to you. And if you're by yourself, it means that on a daily basis, you make wonderful encounters. So being by yourself doesn't mean being by yourself all the time. But at the same time, when you're cycling, it means that you can decide without compromising with someone else where you go, how fast you go, for how long you go, on which terms you go. And I really enjoyed that experience. And then what I really enjoy by cycling long distances by myself is that I know that there is no one that's going to come to solve any problem if there's any problem that arises. And I love this life reminder that, yeah, that's fine. Nobody's going to come. I don't need anyone to come. I can manage. You make decisions much faster. You categorize options much faster. You keep calm much more easily. You become the leader of yourself in a very organic and simple way. And I find that this is daily life lessons that enrich you as you cycle.
I've brought this up a number of times, but it really is this mindset that it's the mindset that you tackle your goal with, which shapes how that goal would be. And I've undertaken tours, and I have undertaken my ultra cycling event, which I did solo as a solo female traveler. And perhaps this is more as an anxious person. My mindset shift needs to make a different connection and a different switch, because as a solo female traveler, I hit myself with my own roadblocks, which is those of threats and perceptions of threats and perceived threats. Did you ever have that at all before you set off?
I think it always comes at some point, mostly because people throw those at you. When you're a woman and you say that you're going to go somewhere far away from civilization by yourself, this is the first thing that they will tell you. Aren't you afraid? If anyone comes, what are you going to do? How are you going to manage? And I always found that these were people's fears. They were not my fears. Because when there's no one, there's nothing to be afraid of. And in the outback, there's no one. And I was camping in the wild by myself. The deal with myself was that I'd make sure that nobody would see me when I came out of the road, so that I knew that no one would know I was there. If no one knows, you're safe. And I do agree that it can happen that for any kind of strange reason, there's this one person somewhere that actually saw you. But this is so unlikely to happen that I call that bad luck. And bad luck, you can have it absolutely everywhere at any time. And I am not going to build my life being afraid of the bad luck, because it's always going to be there. So I don't think this should change my mindset. This should change my plans in any way. I just accept maybe one day I'll have bad luck in my life. But if I don't try to prevent it all along, I will have done a lot of amazing things before it comes.
It's that sort of, you've taken that own level of, it's not that you've gone into that blind, it's you've considered it, but also in a way problem solved already or risk managed it in your own mindset about, well, this could happen and this is how I'll make sure that I prevent this scenario from being a problem for me. That sort of scenario of pre-planning, making sure people aren't seeing where you're camping, and not being blind to the potential concern or, you know, potential threats, but actually finding a way to deal with them and seeing that it's not a deal breaker, that you are able to take this journey.
Yeah, absolutely. A plane crashing, it is extremely unlikely to happen. And I do agree that if it ever happens, that's really dramatic. But you're not going to organize your entire life considering something that is so unlikely to happen. And having, like, being the victim of an aggression in the outback when nobody knows that you're there is extremely unlikely to happen. And that's why I decide to call it back luck, and this is not going to dictate my life.
I'm going to borrow that expression from you for me.
Go for
don't
it.
Don't let bad luck, this perception of bad luck, to dictate the choices that I've made. I love it. I also probably wouldn't watch the Blair Witch Project before, you know, wild camping in the outback.
I haven't seen the Blair Witch Project. Everybody was talking to me about Creek something movie. I forgot, Wolf Creek.
Yes. Oh, no, I don't do horror movies.
But this is based on true events. And so apparently there was one serial killer in the outback who had several victims that were backpackers. But again, considering the millions of people that have traveled in the outback, if there was one serial killer, that is what I call extremely unlikely to happen. And then it falls in the bucket of bad luck.
And something that you have yourself gone through the process of preparing and risk managing for. If I was to actually draw back on that idea of preparing and preparing yourself once you've committed to a goal, to how you will complete that and thinking of things, how did you prepare, I guess, yourself and your bike for this type of tour? Because the terrain that you are on, was it purely asphalt roads? Were there a lot of dirt tracks as well?
I decided not to go on the dirt tracks. So there always are a little bit, but the proportion was ridiculous, like insignificant. I decided to stick to the highway, simply because I didn't want to take months to do this. Because this was one project, part of many others, I would say, in my life. And that was really the reason. And also, I think anybody that got lost for days in the Bolivian desert has done enough cycling in deep sand for life.
you don't want to be in a situation where you're trying to determine which dirt track you need to be taking.
Yes. But because I did stick to the asphalt most of the time, I knew that the risks of having any like mechanical problems with bicycle were less, but I still prepared trying to think of what may break, what may need maintenance, what kind of spare parts I had to carry with me. As a woman, I really wanted to make sure that I would be able to manage everything myself on the bicycle, because I really dislike when someone comes and tells me that I need a man to repair something on my bicycle. I don't need a man, I need tools. Or a person that knows how to repair something. Maybe I don't know how to repair, but that's not necessarily a man. And so I thought this was actually really important for me to show that I just carried my tools, my spare parts, and I had no problem whatsoever on the bicycle that I built myself. I do the entire maintenance myself. I prepared it myself. And we managed, the two of us together, those 3,000 plus kilometers.
It's another thing in your repertoire and your own toolkit is bike maintenance. And I mean, you get to put that to the test straight away because you have to dismantle and pack your bike for flight or for travel and then actually put it together as well. And I think it's empowering and also emboldening as a female cyclist to know that you can do your own repairs. I think that's great because that again helps you in that mindset of, you know, you've done that preparation, so you know things may happen, but you're ready for them.
Absolutely.
You mentioned earlier, Florence, that you know traveling in this manner sometimes becomes a magnet for other people. But you also, and it's another example of your mindset, used this as the power of encouragement and in interactions with people. Can you explain what I'm talking about there?
So the whole idea of this One Dream Down campaign, even though I was alone on the road, I feel that I was one of many. And I have met many people that told me, oh, this is wonderful what you're doing. I would not be able to do this. This sounds like too much. And I think that when there's more encouragements and more examples of something that seems to be too extraordinary, when you provide more examples of people that are doing similar things, then this dream becomes less extraordinary, less inaccessible, less crazy. And the One Dream Down campaign is about being able to say, one dream down, a million to go, and keep on thinking of the million other people and the million other dreams that they're going to realize. And I've been wanting to encourage other women who are cycling long distance to help them keep on going and at the same time help raise awareness that they're everywhere. And that cycling long distance as a woman isn't something that extraordinary, that it can be achieved by many, if any, potentially. And that if it's not cycling that you dream of, any kind of dream that you have in mind is as accessible as cycling long distance.
Sorry, I'm just so enthusiastic listening to you share your story. It comes across that you're just passionate about this project and passionate to help others achieve these type of goals as well. When you come across people who perhaps say, I'd love to do that, I've wanted to do that, but, and you hear them reference but and then shift to a reason or their perception of what's stopping them and their roadblock, what would your advice be to that person?
I always ask them more questions to try to help them understand why they see something or another as a roadblock and help them see that maybe there are other options to what they're describing that would still enable them to reach their own dream. I think that one thing that is extremely important is to pursue your own dream and not the dream of others. For example, anybody that hears that I've done, or many people that I hear that I've done Ironman would be saying, oh, I'd love to do that. And I've been in a situation asking, oh, you like cycling? You like running? You like swimming? No, I hate all this, but I'd love to be able to say I did an Ironman. And then I'm like, choose something that you like. You know, 20 hours of training a week is a long time. And that's not just 1 week, that's months. And but when you are able to identify something that gets you so excited, that it's going to carry you and energize you through the entire process, that's something you should really not let go of. And I think I when I hear people raising all these risks and these fears and these obstacles, then I try to help them see that maybe there are other options to what they're describing, and also help them focus on the energy that they can draw themselves from their dream, from imagining, realizing it. I've had the idea of this One Dream Down campaign after competing in Ironman, because Ironman was something absolutely unpredictable for me, or the aftermath of it was unpredictable, is that I had many of my friends that got extremely enthusiastic about me competing, which I had not expected at all. And on the day, I had a support crew of 9 friends who traveled to be there with me. And I had 50 friends from around the world that were following a WhatsApp group where my support crew would post videos, pictures, explain to them where I was, interview me in the middle of the course so that, yeah, my friends from everywhere around the world could follow up. And afterwards, many of my friends took up new projects, and some of their kids took up new projects, saying that seeing me reaching my finish line had really inspired them and made them remember that there was this project they really wanted to achieve. And I had absolutely not meant to do that. I had not thought of creating this WhatsApp group that's really friends that asked for it. I was not telling anyone, go for your dream or anything. I was just doing my own thing and enjoying myself. But when I saw that, letting people see you realize something that you deeply care about had a true power and was empowering them to dream for themselves and remember that they could work towards their own finish line. I realized that maybe I could do the same, but this time I could let people see me and actively remind them you can do it.
I love that through your own personal cheer squad, that power of people encouraging you to reach your goal flipped around to then being the catalyst for them being something that made them realize that they would be able to achieve something similar, or their goal and their passion. And what helped that is what you were saying. You are very passionate about what you do, and that's why you've almost already reached the finish line when you've committed, because you're so passionate about it. It's not a chore for you. There's things you've needed to do to train and prepare and make sure you're in the right physical shape to endure. But because you are so passionate about it, it's not like a job. It's not something that's been very hard for you to be motivated for. But I love that idea that your cheer squad then was motivated by you to then motivate themselves. Yes. That's fantastic.
On the day of Ironman, I have a friend that decided to do one himself. And the following year, I came back on the course, but to be on his cheer squad.
Oh, I love it. It's like a full 360. Mm-hmm. Florence, I've really enjoyed hearing your story. I think there's lots of takeaways for me personally, and I think our listeners will feel the same. Something I like to ask all my guests before we wrap up the show. Again, it is cycling related, and I've kind of already asked you one of these questions before, but just to keep it the right way, I'll ask you again. If you have the choice of cycling in a perpetual uphill or into a really, really strong headwind, like the strongest headwind you've ever imagined, which one are you choosing?
Oh, wow. This is such an interesting question. I think I'll go for the headwind because it reminds me I'm alive.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And secondly, if you had a choice to cycle for 4 hours during the day and you could cycle in your own company or cycle with other people, which one are you choosing?
I completely enjoy both. I think that if I felt that I can make a difference in the people, if I could make a difference in the life of the people that would come with me during those 4 hours, then I would pick that. If that would just be to be there with them without kind of like impacting them in any way, then I'd just go on my own. Because at least if I'm with myself, I feel like I make more differences to my own life.
I love that. I love that your decision is based on what's going to have the biggest impact at the time. Lawrence, for our listeners who want to find out more about you and follow along with your next journeys, where can they find you out there in the World Wide Web?
I think there are three ways, actually. Maybe the most convenient one is my personal website, drflorencecortel.com. But you can also follow the One Dream Down campaign, which is called @OneDreamDown on Instagram and Facebook, which is really about inspiring others to realize their dreams. And on a more kind of business level, and if you're interested to hear about burnout prevention and how we can help very different types of people work together to solve complex problems, you can follow me on LinkedIn at my name, Florence Cortel. The diversity of ways to follow what I do just reflects the diversity of projects that I undertake.
It also reflects your personality as well. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. And for our listeners, I'll provide links to all of those means of keeping in touch and following along with Florence in the show notes. Dr. Florence Cortel, it has been an absolute pleasure to hear you tell your story. Thank you for saying yes to sharing it with our listeners. And I know that I will definitely be keeping an eye out on your next adventures and maybe that ultra run from to Uluru.
Maybe. Don't put too many ideas in my mind. Thank you so much. Thank you very much for what you're doing. And I hope that anybody that has listened has had some ideas of the next big thing, big or small thing that they're dreaming of doing it, that they're already thinking of the date.
For sure. Thank you so much, Florence.
Thank you, Bella.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review. It really helps the podcast to grow and reach a wider audience. Also, feel free to share it with others and post about it on your social media. Lastly, do you have your own story you'd like to share with us? Then please get in touch by sending an email to podcast@seektravelride.com and request to be featured as a guest on the show. Until the next episode, I'm Bella Malloy. Thanks for listening.